part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm not doing part. Fanboy.com.
This is Part-Time Fanboy, and my name is Christian Horn, and I am on the line with one of my best friends in the universe, a gentleman named Barry Brewer.
Glad to be here.
And Barry Brewer is a musician, and he works out a lot, and his band, you say the name of the band, because I already messed it up.
It's a hallucinatory effect.
Yeah, for anybody listening, this is our second take, so I totally was like, I named a different band, and that was awful. But anyway.
You had almost the correct number of syllables, though.
I totally did. What the hell was I talking about? All right, and where can people listen to your stuff, Barry?
You know, we post it sometimes on our Facebook page, and also we're on SoundCloud.
SoundCloud. Okay, yes, that's where people go. I should put this podcast on SoundCloud. I haven't done that yet, but that's because it's called Part-Time Fanboy and I'm lazy. But the reason that we're here to, the reason that I'm here with Barry is not to discuss music or working out. We are here to talk about a show that has been near and dear to our hearts for several years, 24. It's been three episodes, 2 weeks ago, 24 started with a new series, called 24 Legacy.
Legacy.
And we have been, very excited about 24 because we have been fans of the original series, for a long time since it, first premiered, correct?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And how many seasons has this thing had it been on? The original series, oh, wow, right after 9/11. So launched on November 6, 2001. Yep. So it is very much a sort of post 9/11. Yeah, I remember when it came out, like people were sort of freaked out. I remember Fox being kind of freaked out that they had this show about terrorism coming on, and they were debating as to whether they were even going to release it when it came out.
I don't remember that, but I do. One of the extraordinary things about 24, the original series, was how predictive it was. And, you know, it really just, the fact that it came out in November of 2001, obviously it had completed shooting and everything prior to 9/11. And it was really prescient. And then also 24 absolutely predicted the first black president as was portrayed in season one, who Barack Obama, you know, came a number of years later. And now and then somewhere along the middle of the series, it predicted a president who would absolutely betray his country, and we're sort of at the beginning of that now. So, true to form, 24 is you know, it's always a few years ahead of the curve.
Yeah, it is. I mean, that's really interesting that you mentioned the David Palmer character, because yeah, I remember when it premiered, and I remember it was an African American president, a black president, and I remember thinking like that was really cool and thinking like it wasn't that big a deal, you know? I think, I remember that it didn't really affect me all that much, but I can see what you're saying, that it must have been like a real big thing when it first happened.
Yeah, I'm sure it was, you know, heavily considered by the writers, and you know, it was incorporated into the plot line, the importance and the historical turning point for the country, and the first episode actually opened with the plotting of David Palmer's assassination, and it was theorized that he was targeted by hate groups that were internal in America.
Wow, yeah. That's amazing. You know what I'm looking at right now is I'm looking at my website, parttimefanboy.com, and do you know the last time that we did a 24 episode, which was for the sort of miniseries Live Another Day? It wow. was exactly 100 episodes ago, and I That's did not awesome. Plan this. I did not plan this. So the episode where we talk about 24 Legacy is going to be episode 189, and we talked about 24 Live Another Day on episode 89 of the Part-Time Fanboy podcast. This is amazing.
This is amazing.
It was meant to be. It was meant to be. So one of our favorite things, I mean, David Palmer, the actor who played David Palmer, which David, I think it's like, Dennis Haysbert or Haysbert, something like that.
That's right. Dennis Haysbert, yep.
Yeah. Something like that. I'm close. He was an amazing actor, and he was a really good template for, you know, what became Barack Obama. But the big reason that we loved 24, the huge reason that we adored 24 is because of our main man, Kiefer Sutherland. I mean, Kiefer That's Sutherland right. made the show. He was great on 24. He was the biggest reason that I loved watching it because he sort of projected that world-weary sort of soldier that kind of always, you know, that sort of stereotypical action hero who's like, I'm so done with this. I'm done with it now. I want to end it and get back to my family. And he just never could. He was always having to step up for his country. And when he did, he added this sort of like really intense emotion and sort of background to his character. And I just remember loving Kiefer Sutherland in that role as much as I know you did, because we would always talk about how awesome Kiefer Sutherland was when we would talk about this show back in the day.
Oh, Kiefer Sutherland brought all the intensity and ferocity to the character. And he was always just about to boil over. And the
explode.
Best part. Boom, and he would boil over.
Yeah, he would lose it. Like every couple episodes, he would start screaming at somebody. He'd be like, you give me the key. You give me the codes. I need the codes. He'd just be screaming.
That's it. And the torture would follow.
Oh, torture. Yeah, torture. Which is so funny, like, because it's so funny, like, how 24, you're talking about, like, how it predicted so much stuff. 24, it turns out, started affecting how people in our, you know, foreign services or like CIA or even contractors that would work for us, Blackwater people, would be treating prisoners, because you would see that it was becoming an influence. Like you would see, like you would hear stories of people citing, like, well, you know, Jack Bauer on 24, like, he tortures people and he gets stuff done. And it's just like this weird cyclical thing where like torture was such a big part of the original show. And you know, obviously torture being sort of a part of that sort of like Dirty Harry, almost even Batman template, where it's like the badass hero. He doesn't fuck around. He kicks ass and he takes knees. He's going to fuck you up, man. You know, it sort of became like the big thing in 24. And it almost would become sort of comical, like towards the end of the run, because we'd always be like wondering, like, what's Jack going to torture someone with now? Like, who's he going to freak out on now? Like, is he going to waterboard somebody? Like, what's he going to do? And it's the most bizarre thing, because you and I are as liberal as they come, but we would get this visceral thrill out of watching like 24. And at the same time, during the George W. years, we would be like, this is awful. How can you torture people? But, you know, we would like cheer on when Jack Bauer was doing it.
He had to do what had to be done.
Yeah, right. Which, you know, according to all, you know, real intelligence people, even what is it, like the current military guy in the Trump cabinet, you know, they're against torture. You know, I think what's his face, Mad Dog Mattis, has been quoted as saying, like, just give me a beer. Give me a couple of beers and a cigarette and I can get more done than than with torture. So, you know, it's just
well, you
so
know,
funny.
Mattis has never had to confront the issues that Jack Bauer had to face. He's never been under that kind of pressure.
He's
you know,
never.
And when you need to extract the information, you've got 20 minutes to do it. There's no time to sit down with a beer. There's no time to enjoy a cigarette with your enemy. Yeah. You got to get that information. You got to
stick a pencil in that guy's knee is what you got to do.
Exactly what you do. And then you got to pour some whiskey in there and light it on fire.
Yeah, yeah, totally, totally. You just, yeah, just jumped at that. Oh, my God. Yeah, no, I mean, it would get ridiculous. And part of the genius of 24 was that you could get so wrapped up in like the intensity or the drama that you would start feeling like this kind of like Jack Bauer's actions would be totally justified and necessary. Like you would be, it totally played to like the male ego of like, I'm just gonna, oh, I'm so angry. Like, oh, terrorism, I hate it, you know? So it really was and always has been sort of like a fun show to watch. And it would get ridiculous at times, but, you know, I think it was on for almost 10 years, like 9 years. And I loved every minute of the Kiefer Sutherland years. Well, I mean, we did, you know, when it came to Live Another Day, I thought that's where it sort of started getting off the rails a little bit, a little ridiculous. But, you know, that's the thing is I haven't had a chance to go back and look at the series as a whole and decide as to whether the show was kind of dopey from the beginning or it kind of just became more dopey or I just grew up and was like, yeah, this stuff is kind of ridiculous. So, you know.
There's definitely some dopiness, but it also kind of created a little bit of depth for the show. His relationship to his family was pretty heavy, particularly in the beginning. And there was an element of sort of family drama, but it created some contrast for what was going on in his life. And I actually went back and looked a little bit at the earlier episodes prior to us talking, because I was really curious because the contrast of 24 Legacy in relationship to the original 24 is it's pretty stark and honestly it's pretty disappointing. I have to say that I'm disappointed with 24 Legacy, and I feel it's very flat.
Yeah, well, okay, we're going to jump right into it. You didn't let me interject that 24 also gave us one of the dumbest TV characters in television history, which was Kim Bauer. As cute as she was, as cute as the actress was, her character would constantly be doing dumb stuff, and you would just be grinding your teeth, like, what are you doing? Like, this is beyond, like, teenage stupidity. But, yeah, as far as 24 Legacy, let's go back a little bit before we discuss our sort of, like, disappointment with the new 24 Legacy, because I think you and I are a little bit on the same page. I kind of want to get started with the fact that 24 Legacy is very much like this is a whole new thing. Kiefer Sutherland is not involved as an actor anyway. I don't know if he's named as a producer on the show, but
he is. He's listed as a producer.
Okay, great, great. But Kiefer Sutherland has moved on to another show called Designated Survivor, which I also watched the pilot of when it premiered. And I have to say, like, I was a little bit like, yeah, this kind of isn't for me, but these days network shows aren't necessarily for me anyway. Right. But, you know, this is not a hard reboot. I mean, it occurs in the same universe. It's a bit of a sequel, but it's a bit of a sequel with a new character. And the new character's name is Eric Carter. And he is sort of like ex-military guy who's working private security. And I kind of felt we were in a little bit of trouble when I saw the trailers for 24 Legacy, because the actor Corey Hawkins, he's a great actor. First of all, he did a little bit of Walking Dead, and he was in Straight Outta Compton, yep. And he was great in that. And I feel like the guy is a very capable and solid actor, but I feel in a way that he is very sort of miscast. What are your feelings on him in general?
It could be that he's miscast, or it could be that the direction is weak and they just have him at sort of one level, because the way that the show starts off, it pretty much just kicks off in high gear, and then there's nowhere to go from there. There's no stakes, you know. You don't feel the tension rise. There's nothing developing, and honestly, he has too many wins right up front. You feel like, okay, this guy is just dominating everybody right from the beginning. So there's not enough challenge that he's faced with. I don't know if it's him or if it's simply the story structure and the direction.
Well, it's really interesting because I remember with Kiefer Sutherland. I mean, obviously Kiefer Sutherland has a long and, you know, distinguished, you know, career as an actor. And he's been around for a long time. And I remember when the show was premiering, he sort of was maybe one of the first sort of big celebrities to like maybe transfer to TV and sort of do it successfully. You know what I mean? Because remember, there was a time where like if you were a movie star, you were not doing a TV series. That sort of meant like that your career was going downhill. You know what I mean? And Kiefer Sutherland, I remember when that show premiered, it was very much a lot of people were like, well, you know, can he carry a TV show? Are you going to buy him as a special operative? And Kiefer Sutherland's physicality and sort of the way that he carries himself, and, you know, he was sort of getting older when the show, you know, he wasn't like the young sort of Lost Boys, you know, actor that we were when he was probably introduced to us. You know, he had this gravitas to him, you know, this world weariness already, you know, because I also feel like he's also a celebrity, an actor that had been put through sort of like the rumor mill, the grind mill. So I feel like he carried sort of this world weariness about him, and he was able to transfer that to the character that he played. Now, I don't know anything about Corey Hawkins. I don't know anything about his life. I don't know. But I think even with the physicality, and I'm not saying like black African American, I'm like down with that. I'm like, let's do that. That's awesome. But I feel like he's a little too slight of frame. I feel he's a little too fresh faced to be playing a character like this that is as intense. As a matter of fact, there is the actor that plays, I believe, his brother. His name is Ashley Thomas. When his brother was introduced, I was like, that's the guy who should be playing Eric Carter, because he has that intensity. He sort of has that weariness about him. Of course, he's playing sort of like a drug dealer, which is sort of, you know, another thing that I want to get to about this show that I'm a little uncomfortable with. But, you know, I don't know that Corey Hawkins has that physicality that I buy him as having been in conflict, you know, in combat and survived it, and sort of having like not PTSD, but, you know, I've seen the shit, you know what I mean? Because to me, it almost looks like Corey Hawkins has never worked a serious day in his life. Like, not even carpentry. Like, you know what I'm saying? You know what I'm talking about?
I do. I think you nailed it when you said he's really fresh faced. You know, he's a really young guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, it makes sense that he would have served, you know, in the military at this point.
Yeah.
And had seen combat and that he's out, but he's really young and for the role. Now, something to keep in mind, and this is something that's a little bit confusing, is he's not actually part of CTU. He's not actually an agent at all, whereas Jack Bauer,
that's right,
is a career intelligence officer, and he also came from the same branch of the military that Eric Carter, Corey Hawkins's character, came from, because Jack was a Ranger also, if I recall correctly, and part of the Coral Snake Brigade, I think, and because you remember the tattoo that he had on his arm.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And I believe that was part of the Rangers. So the fact that Corey Hawkins' character is part of the Rangers, maybe they're really trying to get a long-term view and develop him into the agent that he's going to become. And so that might be where this is actually headed. So that's sort of my interpretation of where they're planting him at this point. But as a result, it feels like he's very fresh-faced, and it feels like he might be out of its depth in relationship to the enemy that he's fighting and the circumstances that he's actually in, because it's a very sophisticated terror network that he's encountering now, and his original tasks were to essentially, you know, infiltrate a foreign nation and kill the enemy. Very straightforward.
This
special
is when he was in the Rangers, right? Yeah,
exactly. When he was in the Rangers, but now he's tasked with much more sophisticated intel operations, sort of. But that's kind of the way that it's developing.
Yeah. Well, when the series opens up, he's working security for, like, I don't know exactly what it was, but he's working private security now, you know,
right.
He's sort of like retired and, from the military. And actually what you find out is that he is in hiding, because his unit did something in Afghanistan, I believe. I'm not exactly sure. Whether if it's Afghanistan or Iraq, whatever, in the Middle East. And it ended up having to do with, like you said, taking a very specific target out, right?
Yes.
But it was such a covert operation, or the threat was so terrible that him and the rest of his unit had to go undercover. I had to go into the witness protection program. So when we're introduced to him, he's sort of like coming home from like a night shift, and his wife is, I believe, a nurse or working in a hospital. And we also see some other operations going down where people are being killed and tortured, and we don't know what that's all about. And what ends up happening is that he gets word from another veteran who was in his unit that the rest of his unit has been taken out by somebody. They don't know who exactly. And he gets the warning. And as soon as he gets the warning, these sort of like terrorists break into his house and try and take him and his wife out. So that's, you're sort of like off to the races in the first episode. You know what I mean? Like everything's sort of established, his character's established. And at the same time, you've got subplots with other characters, a former head of the CTU, who is, I believe,
Rebecca Ingram, played by Miranda Otto.
Yeah. And she's basically retiring so that she can help her husband, played by Jimmy Smits, run his presidential campaign. And
that's right.
Of course, this is very much the sort of, you know, to use the title of the show, the legacy of 24, that she's trying to get out of something and this stuff starts occurring and she can't pull herself away from CTU. And hence the hijinks begin with this character sort of being Eric being pulled into this sort of like intrigue of people trying to assassinate him. And you're very dead on with a lot of stuff, which is that you're right. I feel like this guy is introduced to something and, or the action starts and there is no real sort of, like struggle on his part. You don't really sort of believe that, what is it? There's something that's lacking. I feel like there's a sense of like real looming danger that's lacking. And it may have to do with the direction of the show. Right. I mean, I don't know.
I think that's it. It's exactly what it is. There is no sense of just pending doom, and you feel like Eric Carter is going to get through any sort of scrape that he happens to be in, and there the sword just isn't hanging overhead there, and the threat just doesn't feel like it's snarling and around the corner and just about to pounce and tear your throat out.
Yeah.
And that's something that all of the other episodes had. And some of them were a little bit more memorable than others. The nerve agent that they deployed inside of a hotel during the original 24, that was very powerful. And you felt like you understood what the consequences were going to be, or when the terrorists took control of all the nuclear reactors across the United States, and
yeah,
the way that that escalated. Now, this may very well build up to something severe, because he's at this point in the first two episodes, he's trying to contain the list of a huge number of sleeper cells within the United States, and the prime villain is seeking to activate these sleeper cells. And just in the last episode, if I can skip ahead to episode 3, is that okay?
Yeah, I mean, we could skip around. But...
All right, cool. If that's okay, just to mention that I'm hoping that the sense of doom, the sense of danger that you indicated starts to open up, because he's lost control of the drive that has the sleeper cells on it, and it's fallen into the hands of the enemy. So hopefully now the stakes go up, and that sense of danger actually grows inside of the show.
Yeah, well, it's really interesting, because I think one of the things that you said was like that you felt like that Eric Carter could succeed at everything. And I don't necessarily get that, like he's some sort of military Superman. I sort of got that more out of Jack Bauer, but because he gets captured like in the very beginning, and he's almost killed. Like his wife like distracts them or something. He gets like tied down in a chair. So, I mean, I get that I don't get that he's like this military Superman, but I think that you're onto something because the stakes are more personal to him. And in previous seasons of 24, like you said, the stakes are larger, you know, like it starts off with his life in danger. And it's like, well, that's great. I mean, I could be sympathetic to that, but the hallmark of 24 is that the shit is going down. You know what I mean? Like there is something like truly, there is a real, clear and present danger to the country, and it's going to affect us all. Now, part of the plot, what occurs is, you know, that Eric meets up with this homeless veteran who he never knows if this guy's crazy or not, because he's suffering from PTSD and he lives on the street. But Eric has, you know, promised to look out for this guy because, you know, brothers in arms and all that. And what ends up happening is that at some point I believe it's even in the first episode, they discover a hard drive, a thumb drive that has a list of sleeper cells in the United States and ready to be activated at any moment. And this other veteran, this homeless veteran, basically stole it during their raid. He stole a bunch of money, a bunch of other stuff, and didn't realize that he had stolen this drive. And that's what these terrorists are doing here in the U.S. They're trying to find this drive. They're not here for vengeance. They're here just trying to find this drive and kill everyone and locate everyone that was in that unit and kill them so that they can have this drive, so they can presumably reactivate the sleeper cells, right? And that is sort of like, and that's that, you're right. Like at that point, you're sort of like, yeah, this is the big threat. But the way that things go, it just doesn't escalate like from the beginning. As a matter of fact, and this was my complaint, and this was sort of my complaint, if I remember, of Live Another Day. In the first episode, you're off to like Dopey Town. You know what I mean? Things get very silly, like straight from the beginning, where I'm sort of like rolling my eyes and going, come on, really? Because, you know, one of the first things that he does is plug this thing into his phone, which, you know, I was going off with my friends on Facebook, like, how did he plug it into his phone? You can't plug a thumb drive like directly into your phone, which you know, corrected me on. Apparently a year ago, they started manufacturing these things. And and our Facebook, well, our friend Drew Golden also pointed out to me, like, in Asia, they've had that thing for years. And I was like, well, screw you. We're in America now. You know, but in any case,
we don't get technology till it's 10 years old.
Exactly. And, you know, so for me, for my nerd rage to be focused on the fact that you can't plug a hard drive into the phone instead of like being wholly focused on the show, you can sort of see the weakness there. But, you know, the big joke between you and me when we were sort of texting each other back and forth was like, dude, okay, as soon as you plug that thumb drive into your phone and as soon as you know what it is, you're shoving it up your ass. Like, you are like, you are basically either, like you said, instantly copying that data to your phone, or my solution was I'm shoving it up my ass and nobody else can have it. I'm shoving it down my pants. I'm sticking it in my crotch, like immediately, right. As soon as you realize the importance of this, like, you are like, I need to protect this at all costs. I'm going to swallow it, or, you know, whatever you need to do. So my point is like for him to kind of like stick it in his phone, realize what it is and be like, blah, 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 instead of putting it in the most secure place on his body immediately, to me is the complete height of idiocy. Because
I can't remember. How did he actually lose possession of it?
There's
did
like he an had- explosion. They get tracked down and there's an explosion and then he drops it. You know,
okay.
And it happens, it doesn't happen immediately, but as soon as you realize what that data is, like, you're pulling it out and you're shoving it down your crotch. Like, you're putting it in your jacket. You're putting it someplace that it's not going to be like found immediately or taken away from, instead
or,
of like, keeping it plugged in your phone.
You could share it at dinner with your friends at Mar-a-Lago.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Along with the nuclear football.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, you know, maybe take a picture with it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so for me, like, exactly. That just shows you where we're at right now. But for me, like, the whole thing of him, you know, finding out what this thing is and being like, And you know, saying to his friend, it's a list of sleeper cells. It could be activated at any moment, you know, expositionary dialogue. And just sort of like, they're sort of like, oh my God, blah, blah, blah. As I wouldn't even say that to somebody. I would be like, oh shit, I know what this is. I'm shoving it down into my underwear. Like, it is not going anywhere. And then I'm explaining to the guy what it is. You know what I'm saying? Because
sure, or maybe he should have emailed it over to CTU immediately.
Exactly. Like, copy.
Might have been
over.
A good idea. Yeah, right. Yeah,
you figure it's like a document, right? It can't be
That's
that.
It.
It's not that big data. You know, it's not that large a data pile. You could probably copy it immediately, right? And
absolutely, you texted it.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a part of me that's just like watching this, and I'm like, wait a minute. So that's sort of like the big first. Plot fuck up as far as I'm concerned with 24 Legacy. But then he discovers this plot of terrorists going after him, going after his family, going after his compatriots. And basically he gets his wife and transports her to his brother, because his brother is the only person that he can trust his wife's safety with. He can't go to the police. He can't go to anybody else. He has to go to
his brother,
drug dealer.
The drug kingpin.
Yeah, exactly. His brother, the drug kingpin, so that he will protect his wife. And, you know, there's drama there because his brother was the guy who he stole his his wife from because his brother was involved with the wife. And I'm just sitting there like, eye roll, eye roll, eye roll. Like, this is like ridiculous. Like, we are really getting into, soap opera territory. So he convinces his brother to watch. He convinces his brother, who they supposedly hate each other, to watch his wife while he has to go off adventuring to figure out what's going on, because apparently no one at CTU except for Rebecca Ingram can be trusted. And here's where the shit gets really stupid, because Rebecca Ingram is fucking told by Eric Carter that there is a hard drive out there with a list of operatives, sleeper cell operatives, and immediately Rebecca Ingram does not get on the phone to the president. She's like, this is the day that I'm going to retire. I have to help my husband with his presidential campaign. But wait, I am going to sit here at CTU, grab one of my operatives, and we're just going to do this, the two of us. And then the other thing that drives me crazy is that as soon as Rebecca Ingram discovers that there is a hard drive with sleeper cells waiting to be activated at a moment's notice in the United States, she decides that the best plan of action is to have one operative chasing the drive. One person. And that person is, you guessed it, Eric Carter. Now, I don't know about you, I'm in charge of stuff at my job. At my job, if something is complicated and really important, and I'm not even close to being like in, it's not on the level of importance as a hard drive with the sleeper cell that is going to activate tons of operatives and cause chaos in the United States. If I think that I have got a really tough job, I'm going to get more than one person on that, because you know, it's complicated. And so the head of the CTU decides, I've got to keep this on the down low. Now, in the show, basically, the reasoning for her doing this is to say, is because the new head of CTU, the counterterrorism unit, is one of the suspected people of having leaked the existence of this hard drive to the terrorists.
Right, because there were only three people, three directors, who actually knew what the identities were of the Ranger team that went into whatever Middle Eastern country it is that they invaded and killed whichever terrorist group it was that they killed.
Exactly. So instead of gathering the three in a room with the president immediately, or the vice president, God forbid, it's not Trump, but you know, instead of gathering these three people, you know, who are the heads of their departments, to the vice president, to another person, to other people in her organization, and bringing them together and say, you've been accused of this, we're going to sequester you. She decides to do it in secret with one guy, one guy at the computer and another guy out in the field. Yeah, that's smart. It must be the Trump administration, because, you know, this shit is like, this is not how you do stuff. You know, you would have squads of people descending to get this hard drive, and it would be done within an hour. There's your show over. It's not 24, it's called 60 minutes, and we're done.
60 like, minutes.
Like, it's like ridiculous. Like, and you know, it doesn't get any smarter as the show goes on. That's the problem. Like, this has become a show where I'm like, I'm like, oh, okay. How dumb can this get now? Like, you know what I mean? And that's right.
And the other shows, where you had situations that the members of CTU were forced to behave in a certain way that was way out of bounds and completely out of protocol, they were snookered or cornered by their adversaries and enemies.
Yeah.
And it actually took a little bit, it took time for those things to develop and for the pressure to be just so intense that they had to start to make completely, totally radical and insane decisions. and the fact that she immediately arrived at the idea that she's going to be the one who runs with the ball and not notify the president and not sequester the people who knew the identities of the Ranger team is completely ridiculous, because that was not the situation hadn't reached that point yet.
Yeah, exactly.
And that was something that the previous episodes used to do. It progressed to the point. It progressed to the point where in one season, as you recall, was it season 3 or 4, where Jack Bauer actually had to execute the head of CTU.
Oh, shot, yeah.
Shot him in the back of the head inside of a rail yard. And,
I remember that.
And that's another thing. I don't know if Eric Carter is ever going to have what it takes in order to make the decisions that Jack Bauer can make. I don't know.
Yeah, he definitely does not have the gravitas.
He doesn't. And, obviously what her first mistake was just not bring Jack Bauer out of retirement. That would have saved the show.
Yeah, exactly. Let's just call Jack Bauer. What's Jack Bauer doing? But here's where, in writing and in plot, the show really goes off the rails, because people, if you thought what we were explaining was dumb, just wait. Here it comes. It's about to get dumber. Because what ends up happening is that Eric Carter's friend, compatriot, soldier in arms, who had the hard drive, is the one that recovers it. And he's basically like, I want $2 million or something like that. I think it's $2 million, $2 million in cash, or else I turn the hard drive over to the terrorists, because maybe they'll give me the money. And okay, this guy's got PTSD. He's been living on the streets. He's not thinking right. I get that. But, Eric Carter presents this plan to his boss, or his former boss, who really has no authority anymore within CTU. And she's like, well, I can't get the money. And so what's the plan we come up with? Guess what? We're going to invade the LAPD police department, and we're going to try and get into a stash of drug money in the police precinct. And that's how we're going to get the money, people. This is how we're going to get the money. We're going to send in a Army Ranger, he gets himself arrested by the police, because you know what? He's a black man in the neighborhood. And if he's walking around, he can get arrested easily, which, whatever you think about that part of the plan. Okay. But his idea is to get arrested.
That's probably the most solid piece of writing.
Probably. And, he gets himself arrested, gets taken to the police, inside the police precinct, so he can take out the cops and intimidate them or terrorize them into getting into the evidence locker so he can steal $2 million worth of cash.
Right.
That is the when I heard this plan, I had to shake my head. I had to be like, what? What just happened? You're trying to tell me that the best course of action for anyone is to go to my drug dealer brother, find out where he can get $2 million of cash. My drug dealer brother tells me, hey, yeah, there's probably a stash in this precinct in the LAPD. And so I'm going to beat the shit out of two LA cops and break into an LA police precinct and steal $2 million so I can bait the terrorists with it.
Yeah.
Instead of maybe trying to find out a way of counterfeiting, getting newspaper, filling up a bag, getting maybe counterfeits of money and putting it on the top of the bag and being like, this is the money to take to the drop. Beyond that, it's just the dumbest plan ever.
It was a terrible plan, and it doesn't make any sense.
Not at all.
And did you see how it resolved?
Oh, yeah. No, as of this point. So this is where the writing really goes off the rails, because really goes off the rails? It already went off the rails. But at this point, oh, my God, it's just so infuriating. Basically, you've got a situation where he gets discovered in the police locker. The SWAT team is moving in, and they've set up, by the end of the second episode, it's like a giant cliffhanger.
I'm sorry. I got to ask you a question here. at some point or other, when he's taken the cops hostage, he has constructed a bomb that he's attached to the basically the lower back of one of the cops. I kind of missed, where did he get the bomb making material? And
he just made it. He's like MacGyver.
What did he make the bomb with? Like, he had extra C4 in his pocket or something? I have no idea how he made that.
I don't remember exactly at a construction site, but my point let's go back to the point of the fact that he's strapping a bomb, and it's a real bomb for all intents and purposes. At no point does he say to anybody or reveal or anything or say like, oh, this is just like a fake bomb, I'm gonna freak him out. You know what I mean?
Right.
No, he's strapping a real bomb onto a member of the LAPD whose kind of only crime is being a racist dick, which is a crime because he's sort of like the older grizzled cop who's like, look, it's a black guy, I gotta go pull him over. Yeah, that's shitty. I agree with you, but he's strapping a bomb to the back of this guy and saying like, if you don't get me into the police precinct, I'm gonna blow you up. That's fucked up, and that's a terrorist.
And your partner and myself.
Yes,
we're just gonna blow up everybody in the entire police station.
That's
anybody
a suicide bomber, kids. In case you didn't know, it's called a suicide bomber. Like, so anyway, he does this and he gets into the police locker. They're discovered. The SWAT team's moving in, and basically. It's a giant cliffhanger at the end of the second episode. And what ends up happening is that Rebecca Ingram, as incompetent as she is, gets discovered by the real head of the CTU, the current head of the CTU, Keith Mullins, played by Teddy Sears. And the whole operation comes to a standstill. And once... the new head of the CTU kind of gets a breakdown as to what's going on and what's happening with Eddie Carter. He basically gets the SWAT team to stand down. And it is the most anticlimactic resolution to a plot point in a TV show that I've ever seen. It's totally like blue balls. It's like you're setting this up to like be like this amazing action escape sequence. And they introduce this sort of like Deus Ex Machina. And it's sort of like, like a big fart in the room. It's like, really? This is what you were building up to? And it's terrible. It's a terrible resolution.
And this is after Eric Carter actually blows a hole through the wall of the evidence room.
That's right.
So first, this is where we learned that the bomb was absolutely real and it would have cut the guy in half.
Yeah, exactly.
So he blows a hole in the wall, and he's recruited the assistance of the other cop that he's already taken hostage through by convincing the cop that he's a secret agent who's on in hot pursuit of terrorists.
Yeah, yeah.
And the young cop was like, is that true? I think. I think he actually says that.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that stuff about the terrorists true?
Yeah, yeah.
And then Eric Carter gives him a look and a nod, and then the young cop's like, "Well, it must be true."
Well, not even that. Let's skip ahead to the point where the cop agrees to work with Eric Carter, and then as soon as the shit goes down, Eric Carter grabs the agreeable cop, not the cop who was going to blow up, grabs the agreeable, nice, fresh-faced, young rookie cop, and puts a gun to his head and says, "Motherfuckers, I'm going to shoot this guy in the head if you don't let me out."
The young cop must be like, what the fuck, man? I was just trying to help you.
I was trying to help you, and you just turned on me. Like, what the hell is that?
What kind of bullshit is this?
Exactly. I didn't sign up for this shit.
And how come the young cop, he's obviously an idiot, but I mean, isn't he like, wait a second, if you're really an American agent who's in pursuit of a terrorist, you know what? Fuck you. I'm walking away from this right now.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you're gonna kill me? You're not gonna shoot me.
Exactly.
We're on the same team, supposedly.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm done.
Exactly. Or why didn't you go straight to the police? Like, there's
if Woody
none,
had
I don't
gone
remember.
Straight to the police.
Yeah, exactly. If Woody had gone straight to the police. At no point in the dialogue is there, look, the head of the CTU has been infiltrated between him and the cop. There's no explanation as to, like, the big thing that's really going on. Like, the cop never
that's a good
says,
point. Like, I just happened to be here trying to steal $4 million. This is the obvious decision that we would make.
Exactly. Why, you know, I mean, seriously, the government could pull $2 million out of their ass. Why are you even here? You know what I'm saying? Like, it's ridiculous. So that for me was sort of the really major turning point when that sort of like in the episode of this week, because we're three episodes in at this point, that was the major turning point for me where I was just like, you've got to be fucking kidding me with this. Like, this is ridiculous. Like, look, man, I read superhero comics. I freaking love superhero movies. I can take some ridiculous, nonsensical explanation stuff. But if you're setting this in the world of 24, which granted has had some ridiculous, I mean, in the first season, the wife gets amnesia, doesn't remember, has an accident. You know, granted, there's some soap opera stuff in there. But once you start, at that point to me, it's like you're not even trying. You wrote yourself into a corner and you could have given this like amazing action escape set piece, and you didn't give us that. And instead, it's just the drama about the drug dealer brother's boyfriend's girlfriend, you know, trying to, you know, infiltrate or, you know, take over the brother's, you know, drug dealing car. Who cares? I don't give a crap about that. And at that point, it's at the same time, it's like, I don't give a crap about the wife. Like, do they kill her? Okay, great. Let's move on because this isn't important to me. Like, and nothing wrong about the actress, nothing wrong about her portrayal, nothing. But they've not set up like this as something to really, really sort of give a shit about. You know what I mean?
Right. I mean, the extent of what we're supposed to base our concern for the wife on is her telling Eric, you know, you really got to figure your stuff out.
Yeah.
And I want to get pregnant.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And we're supposed to be like, well, you know, I certainly hope she comes out of this okay.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, I mean, by the end of the third episode, there is a thing in the LA subway thing where, is it LA subway? I can't remember exactly. It was just like two nights ago. That'll show you how engaged I am. But by the end of the episode, the homeless vet leads Eric Carter to the hiding place of the drive, and he is trying to carve open like a little stone or tile where he hid the thing. And at that point, Eric Carter should be shooting him in the head and attempting to retrieve the unit himself. I mean, listen, we were in the war together, but you're jacked up, bro. This is not going to work. Like, you know, and you're basically a traitor to your country. You stole this drive. You were trying to sell it back. I'm taking you out and I'm getting it myself instead of waiting for you to retrieve the drive from your little hidey hole. And, you know, at that point, a shootout occurs because you were waiting for the PTSD homeless guy to open the little hidey hole that he had it in.
Jack Bauer never would have dropped the ball like that.
No way. Jack Bauer would have taken that MF-er out. Big
he
time.
Definitely would have. And, you know, he might not have shot the guy, but he definitely would have slapped him with the gun. And
yeah, exactly.
And grabbed the drive. There's no question about that. That's a great point.
Yeah,
he never would have made that mistake. This guy, Eric, is he's too fresh-faced. He's too new to the game.
He's too new to the game. He hasn't watched the previous 10 seasons of 24 like you and I have.
Yeah, exactly.
The other thing I kind of want to discuss in a way, you know, beyond, and there's this other subplot with the Rebecca Ingram's husband who's running for president, and you find out that one of his aides is sort of implicated in leaking the information of the unit that Eric Carter was a part of to the terrorists. The big thing that's sort of making me a little uncomfortable about this season is It's just full of stereotypes, man. Like, it really, really is. I mean, it's great that they cast, like, an African-American lead in Corey Hawkins, but the rest, I'm really, maybe it's because of the way everything is going, and I'm not naive to say, like, there are no Middle Eastern terrorists, there are no, you know, Muslim extremists or that sort of thing. You know, I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is, like, aren't we at the point now where the villain, like the Muslim villain, crazy Middle Eastern terrorist thing, it's just uncomfortable to me watching this now, because I'm just like, look, like, is this what we really want to, especially going back to what we were talking about in the beginning of the episode, where like people in the military were looking at 24 and being like, yeah, torture rules. I could do it because Jack Bauer does it. Like, couldn't have this season been sort of, and I think they already did this in 24, couldn't have been this sort of like the white supremacist terrorist season. You know what I'm saying? Like, at this point, I really feel like, you know, this is kind of almost irresponsible in a way. Does that make sense?
I don't know. I mean, it does and it doesn't, because the fact is, I think that Islamic terrorists are still a real threat for the United States. I think it would be naive to think that they are not. And, you know, ISIS is a very real group. Al-Qaeda is, you know, I mean, ISIS is so awful that Al-Qaeda, it's like nobody even worries about Al-Qaeda anymore.
Yeah, I know.
That's how fucked up
it is. I'm not disputing that point, but I think with the way that things are going with this Muslim ban and the way that certain people in this country are characterizing the Muslim community, I really feel like this is a little bit irresponsible. You know what I mean? Especially the first three episodes of the season, you're sort of not getting a vibe of any sort of like really upstanding Muslim, you know, citizenry in this. And it's sort of starting off like just negatively. And it kind of bothers me. I'm like, dude, right now we're in a really sensitive time in this country. And I feel like to have the villains just be like, you know, I mean, look, it is a TV show. You can have license with your villains. What if it was some weird cabal of like, you know, and I'm talking ridiculous, like, you know, like white supremacist Muslim, you know, team up or something like that. You know what I'm saying? To where it wasn't just you could do a fantasy mix or a fantasy terrorist group. Like, what I'm saying is, like, I just feel like the political situation and what's going on, there's a bit of insensitivity to how people are being, a certain group is being portrayed, where they're the only villains, you know? I think if you wanted to go really crazy, why not make Eric Carter a Muslim?
That would actually be interesting. That would have been a good thing to introduce.
Because I just think that there's so much, like, you know, and I get it. Like, I understand, I'm with you, and I understand that this is a danger in the world right now. But for me, watching this right now and the way that the political situation and the way that I feel that Muslim people should be portrayed in media today, I think we need to expand that. And by making them solely Muslim, making their characteristic Middle Eastern, you know what I'm saying? Like, for me, I'm a bit uncomfortable with it. And I find it kind of tired. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm a little tired of that. I feel like creative writing or creatives should be looking, I'm not saying to dispute it, but maybe other avenues of villainy. You know what I'm saying? Like, it doesn't have to be this thing, because I feel like it just reinforces a stereotype and reinforces a certain way of looking at people that I don't think is necessary at this point anymore. There's enough in the news. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and I do understand what you're saying. And, you know, spinning it towards a white supremacist group might be an interesting tack to take. I think in the show may be setting up for a little bit more to reflect more of what you're saying, because they are p- painting really broad strokes up front by saying that these terrorists are Muslim, and obviously they're going to be Muslim because Muslims are terrorists.
Is
sort of the message of the show, kind of. And but then you have the campaign manager, or the chief of staff of the senator who's running for president, and then you see that he defends her at one point, but then his father has framed her to look like she is a Muslim who has ties to a radical mosque, but then I think maybe the show is going to try to twist it a little bit to try to be able to show some balance and maybe to reflect some of our collective prejudice, or the prejudice that is absolutely getting manifest within the United States and unfortunately around the world. And so I think a lot of what you're expressing, I think it's important. I think it's great to really consider. And
I feel like the thing with the campaign manager, I mean, that's another thing with the writing. I mean, I think it's very obvious that that's going to be resolved in the positive. You know what I'm saying? Like that, it's very obvious that she's going to be exonerated. I mean, vilified in the beginning and then exonerated at some point. I mean, that to me is like, that's telegraphed writing. And if it plays out another way, I mean, I'll be like, oh, wow, that's interesting. You know, that's interesting that that played out that way. But at the same time, I just feel like this is the first three episodes, man. And we are like in a climate where it's like the president of the United States is trying to keep Muslim people, you know, majority Muslim country out. People out of the country, you know, a majority people from Muslim majority countries out of our country. And to me, I'm like watching this show and it's making me uncomfortable. So, but the other point is, and again, I'm a liberal. There's probably somebody in the middle of the country that's watching 24 Legacy is like, fuck yeah, fuck Muslims, you know, whatever. But this is where I'm coming from. I am a bleeding heart liberal, you know, whatever. But the other thing that kind of bugs me is watching this show, and I feel like, is the drug dealer brother. Like, there is a part of me that I'm like, really, dude? Do we have to have, like, this? And it's presented as sort of like, this whole segment of a black community that the lead character comes from and got away from, you know, I got away from those people, you know, and the thing is like, why does a major character, badass, have to be like the drug kingpin? You know what I'm saying? Like, why does he have to be African-American? Why does he have to be black? Why couldn't the guy have been white or, you know, even lesser so Latin or whatever? Even Latin would bother me because I'm Latin, you know. But I'm saying, like, why does it even have to be like this thing? I mean, to me, it's like, it just seems like really highly unbalanced as far as like the way that you're portraying certain groups of communities of people. You know what I mean? And it just seems like really tone deaf to me.
I think you really nailed it at one point. You mentioned that there are a lot of stereotypes in the show, and it's really gotten dumbed down. And they also try to make it clever, like, oh, but it's really not dumbed down. Because then there's this other thing that they do where there's a field agent in CTU, and then there's an analyst in CTU, and the field agent is like this really rough looking tough guy, and the analyst is, you know, just sort of like you know, a sharp analyst, and their first interaction is like, well, you know, you left it left it bad there. And then there was like another line, but it was you that left. And it's like, oh, I see, you guys are gay and you had a relationship and you broke up. Wow, what a twist. And it's so like on the nose, like, look, you know, we're not just, it's not just stereotypes. We can imagine having a gay couple inside of CTU. We're really free thinkers here at the writers at 24 now.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah, yeah.
Yeah, not really.
Yeah, you kind of are, and you're kind of not. I mean, you know, I mean, I definitely applaud having the lead being a different race from, you know, a stereotypical white guy, like, definitely. But sure. At the same time, I feel like that there's so many other sort of violations of tasteless sort of stereotyping in the show, particularly with the way that you're portraying two large groups of American, you know, quote unquote minorities, that I'm a bit uncomfortable with it. I was a little bit like, really? We're going to start off like this? You know what I mean? Especially in the current climate. So it's interesting. I mean, I don't think that 24, even without Kiefer Sutherland, even without the torture, has kind of escaped the sort of criticism that can be levied at it. You know what I mean? Has sort of escaped, you know, the sort of thing. I mean, the thing is obviously they're trying. They have a new lead. They have, you know, they, like you said, they do have gay characters. They have a another sort of Indian, I don't know if she's Indian or Pakistani, you know, Asian character in the mix. But at the same time, I feel like there's such a large negative portrayal of two communities that I'm just like, come on, really? You know what I mean? So that kind of bugged me, and maybe I'm being a little too sensitive. You know, maybe what I talked about negates what is bothering me. But at the same time, it's just something that I'm like, come on, really? Why does the black community, you know, because they're all black. You know, he shows up and they're like living in whatever neighborhood and everyone is black. You know what I'm saying? And it's like, oh, these are the thugs, you know, in the, but they're not really bad because they're going to help the lead character escape, you know, this other group of thugs. You know what I mean? And so I don't know, whatever. But to me,
I don't know. I mean, it's in fairness to, I don't know why I give a shit about being fair to the writers.
Yeah.
You know, there are definitely communities where there are concentrations of ethnicities, and whether there's a criminal element or not a criminal element to it. And people, you know, absolutely segregate themselves based on some of the most obvious dividing lines that exist, and whether it's be it black or Latino or Italian or Irish or Korean or Japanese, and there are all kinds of ways that people quite intentionally segregate themselves. But you know, getting back to the actual show itself, where you have the brother who's essentially an inner city kingpin of whatever drug it is that he's happened to sell. I mean, whether it's cocaine or heroin or whatever it is that he's peddling.
Yeah.
I mean, just as far as the story is concerned, why would the brother who escaped the hood come back? And that's where he feels safest. I mean, just as far as a guy who has gone out into the world, has been part of the Rangers and has, you know, conducted operations overseas, and he can't think of a better thing to do than go.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, go back to see the brother whose girlfriend apparently he stole and married, and they have no other recourse. What about her family? Is it, you know, where's her family in all of this? Or like, exactly. You know, or maybe he could have just, you know, rented a motel room with some cash or
out in the middle of nowhere. Exactly.
The middle of nowhere. Exactly. You know, why not drop her off at CTU? Or,
yeah, exactly.
There's a whole bunch of other different choices, but, the show is absolutely rife with, you know, stereotypes and they sort of base a tremendous amount of the storytelling from those stereotypes, which is pretty, it's pretty weak. And I can absolutely understand the sensitivity of, and the extra awareness of the group that has been framed as the terrorists in the show, particularly now with this horrendous administration of 45s that we have now, and the absolute lunacy that's going on in the country at this time, where basically bigots, particularly towards the Muslim community, have become emboldened. And unfortunately, this show, of course, it was produced before 45 took office. And so there's no way that they knew that this animal was actually going to wind up as the president of our country, and that he was going to take these actions that then sort of magnified the tense relationship that the United States has with the Middle East and with the Muslim community. But he has taken office, and it has exacerbated the tension, and it has made it particularly uncomfortable. And so I don't know. I don't know. Maybe they're aware of it. Maybe they feel uncomfortable about it, and they're like, shit, we invested whatever $75 million or however much it costs to produce such a show. Yeah. And then all of a sudden this dickwad takes office, and they're like, well, we're about to go live with the fucking thing in like a month. So I guess we got to do it, but what can we do?
Well, I mean, I think that's giving them giving anyone, because obviously this sentiment has been rolling around for a while. Right. And I feel like, maybe there was a prediction that Trump wouldn't have won, but at the same time, he was stirring up this shit for a long time, So I feel like it's a little bit, I mean, I don't know, maybe the guys that produce the show are conservative or whatever. But my point is I feel like you're starting off the bat, you've got the first three episodes, and I just feel like these days it's really easy. It's just sort of the easy way out to be like, let's just have Muslim terrorists. You know what I mean? And I'm not saying it's not realistic. I'm not saying that at all. I'm not naive. I know what exists out there in the world, but there are other threats too. And I just think, I feel like in the current climate, you could have seized on those other threats and maybe done something better, or done something different. You know what I mean?
I do. And hope, and maybe the show is going to take a little bit of a turn in a direction that
it could,
because something that that we actually didn't talk about was, we have this Eastern European high school student who is planning on bombing. I don't know. Are they going to bomb the school?
Oh yeah.
And she has seduced a teacher, who also has, I guess he's had inappropriate relationships with students or whatever the case is. However it is that he's built up the resentment to the point where he's actually going to build a bomb to assist her in killing a whole bunch of people. And he thought that he actually murdered one of his high school students right there in his chemistry classroom.
Yeah, I know. That was a dopey ass. I guess that's why I didn't talk about it, because I just think that subplot is so dumb.
It's pretty dumb, but I think that she's connected to, is it Khalid? Is that the name of is that the name of the sort of lead villain?
I think so. And
who's been educated at Cambridge or something like that in England. And so at least there's Western influence that is going on. But of course, that's really not the lens that people are going to see it through. They're just going to be like, Muslim terrorists, evil, bad. They're going to kill Americans.
Yeah.
And that really is, like you're saying, that's on the nose. And it's like, come on, you guys should be a little bit more creative. We've got 9 seasons of the original 24 behind us, and there's going to be this huge following that's going to lock into the show. You guys could be more creative. So, but maybe the sleeper cells will, unfold into something that's more sophisticated than what it seems to be. But I don't know. I'm not holding my breath.
Yeah. I mean, we'll see. We'll see how it develops. So, I mean, that leads us to sort of the big question of this this episode of Part-Time Fanboy. Are you going to continue watching it?
I mean, I'm. Yeah.
The thing is I think I'm at a point where even my superhero shows are falling behind. And yeah. I mean, the lunacy of it. There are shows that I watch sometimes where I'm like, how dumb can this get? You know what I mean?
and how dumb can I be for watching it?
That's true. And there are shows where, and there are shows that I watch particularly not because I am a writer or anything like that, but I really, that I like to learn from and pick apart from and learn lessons about storytelling from and stuff like that. And this is probably going to be that for me. But I could see this show. This could be the first time that 24, I don't know, I'm guessing it's going to be a 24 episode season. Oh no, 13 episodes apparently, according to the Internet Movie Database. Yeah, if it gets really more dumb, there's a lot of good stuff on TV, or there is a lot of other stuff that I have not caught up on. Like, what's that Kevin Spacey show with the politics? I've not watched one episode of that.
And, oh my God, you should forget about 24.
You know, and I'm just saying, like, there's a lot of good TV out there, and I'm getting to the point where, you know, if something's so dumb, I may just stop watching it, you know? So, and I don't have tons of time to watch everything. It is called Part-Time Fanboy. So we'll see. I will watch the next episode, maybe the next couple. I mean, it is a 13-episode season, and I am sort of like a diehard 24 fan because of our man Kiefer. But I can't say, like, this is not a show where I am like, I am going to watch every, I am in, I am in. No. This is not that kind of show for me where I watched, you know, so we'll see. We'll see. Maybe I'll just keep them on my DVR. And when I get bored or have nothing else to watch during the summertime, you know, I'll break it out. But there's a lot of stuff.
And it's a real shame, because the thing about 24 was it was like crack. You had to watch the next one. I mean, it was just like unbearable. You're like, I gotta watch it now. And it was like, that's where, and that it was 24 that really like turned me into and showed me what binge watching was all about. I was like, holy shit, I just watched 10 episodes of 24.
Yeah, that's
like,
right.
That's like fucking 10 hours of television I just watched.
I know. I remember you told me that you watched like a chunk of an old season like in one sitting. I was like, dude, what are you, crazy? Like, that's insane. That's crazy. You're like, Jack Bauer forever! Yeah. So I think we're both saying that we're disappointed in 24 Legacy. We wish Kiefer Sutherland would have come back. Kiefer Sutherland's new show is not 24 to me. I'm not watching it. It's not that compelling to me. I only watched one episode. So, but damn it, Kiefer, we miss you. We miss you on 24.
Thank you.
So anyway, all right, this has been the 24 Legacy episode of Part-Time Fanboy. My name is Christian Horn. I have been on the line with my brother, Barry Brewer, whose band is
Hallucinatory Effect.
And you can find them on Facebook and on SoundCloud. Check them out. They've got some really great stuff. And Barry, are you coming out with like any kind of like, you can find them on iTunes, right? Did you put them up on iTunes?
No, we haven't got it. I'm a little lazy, to be honest. Yeah.
All right. Well, eventually they'll be up somewhere on iTunes, and hopefully you'll find out about it on their Facebook page. In the meantime, thank you for listening to Part-Time Fanboy. Check us out on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all that lovely stuff. And thanks for listening. Hopefully we will have a new episode up soon. Bye.
Part-time. Oh, yeah.